This podcast is for educational purposes only. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect the official policy or position of the Ted Stevens Center, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.
You're from Ottawa, but it seems I saw that even in Vancouver, they've lit the arena in orange and blue. There seems to be some unification in Canada behind the Oilers' effort here to take the first Stanley Cup championship since 1993. Where do you sit in this?
Go Oilers, I would say. It's not the team I normally follow, but of course, Connor McDavid is kind of the player of this generation. And I think there's very little question Canadians, more than usual even this year, are rallying behind the kind of Canada representative in the Stanley Cup Finals. So
yeah, a lot of eyeballs on that for sure. It was a great game, and I think it's the first time they've had back-to-back years in which the two same teams play in the Stanley Cup.
It's a good rivalry.
The last couple of times, the team who lost the first time won the second time, including Edmonton back in the 80s when Gretzky lost to the Mike Bossy-led New York Islanders, and then they came back and won. So maybe history will repeat itself.
Two classic dynasties back then, so let's see how what the present gives us.
Yeah, we'll see what plays out, and let's see if some celebratory riots break out in the Canadian capital for a good thing, I suppose.
Yes.
But, well, not to get too far into sports, although maybe we'll circle back into that, because I know that there is some sort of kind of athletic and sports diplomacy that could even be spoken about in the Arctic space. But I want to start here talking about maybe what falls within your area of expertise, and that's Russia grand strategy. You've been hard at work on a series of white papers on Russian grand strategy. Can you tell us a little bit about that effort, and maybe an overview of how Russian Arctic strategy fits into the Russia's grand strategy overall?
Yeah, right. So MLI over the last half year has invested quite a bit in a project called Russian Grand Strategy in the Arctic. So really trying to tease out and get some more insight into how Russia is, pursuing the Arctic region. Strategy for the Arctic, and as you allude to, as part of its overall grand strategy. So we've really tried to take it, not just looking at the military hard power pieces, but at the kind of socioeconomic and economic development, some of the factors behind Russia's geoeconomic kind of play. So that's been primarily the Northern Sea Route, and then looking at the Arctic Ocean seabed as a part of how Russia's thinking about the world and its power. We've also wanted to get a little bit into attitudes that are being disseminated within Russia. So that was in part one study about Russia's attitudes in the press towards Greenland, Denmark, the United States and Canada, the North American Arctic as an element in the Arctic, as well as looking at the social media channels of governors in the Russian Arctic zone and how they're talking about building relations with China to kind of get at that issue about, how deep is China's hold in Russian thinking, how open are the Russians to allowing China to play a bigger role in the Russian Arctic, which I think is one of the big issues. I also, as part of the project, we've had an intern generate a really great paper looking at some of the main themes and how Putin has talked about the Arctic in the last decade or so, not over his entire term, but over the last 11 years.
Yeah, so speaking of the Russian President Putin, he gave a speech in Murmansk, I think back in February or January of this year, within this year. He was pledging Russia's commitment to developing the Arctic economically, not necessarily new, expanding the NSR, you already mentioned that, securing foreign investments, which is maybe an interesting statement given the context at the time where there was maybe more foreign investment prior to Ukraine. Now the foreign investment might be slightly coming from different areas. But he also expressed some concern about NATO's presence in the Arctic. Of course, we've had Finland and Sweden join NATO since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Alex, how do you think this dual or multi-focus on strategic cooperation and this strategic assertion, sort of this Russian assertion, might impact relations in the Arctic? So on the one hand, you got the economic side of it. On the other hand, there's more of just this international affairs component, NATO expansion or NATO presence. How do you take all this and make something coherent of it all? Mm-hmm. Especially using when Putin's at the dais speaking to this element, and you've already mentioned the Sino-Russo collaboration. So on the economic side, they sort of have to, the Russians would have to pull in the Chinese, but you even brought up the question, do they want to?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's no doubt right now for Putin, and has been, I think, for pretty much, you know, for a large swath of his time in power, you know, pitching the Arctic as a key part to Russians of the country's future economic prosperity. You know, that this is what defines Russia, kind of as part of its identity, what it can offer to the world, you know, and particularly the natural resource, natural resources that the Russian Arctic contains. So you'll find in Russian strategic documents, they talk about the strategic resource base. Mm-hmm. And I think this is, strategic in all senses, strategic for the development of the Russian economy, strategic for its relevance internationally. And, you know, looking at it, they're thinking about national security in all of this. So it's also part of their national security conception, is this strategic resource base. You know, they're very keen to keep Russians in the Arctic and attract Russians to the Arctic to live there. See that a key part as well, you know, demographics picture of how Russia remains relevant and capable, you know, for infrastructure to support that in the north. There's quite a few incentives, et cetera, right now to attract Russians to live there and keep them there. So there's that very, very developed piece. And it's never far from the geopolitical questions, et cetera. So, you know, the NATO kind of discussion, you know, I mean, this actually, when you, some of the work we've done, you look at it, I mean, this has been going on in elements of the Russian press, you know, even predating, you know, back for quite some time, particularly on stuff that's, or, you know, media reporting that's more oriented towards the military. I think, you know, since 2022 and the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, and when the kind of period of, you know, Arctic exceptionalism was kind of, you know, ended, and particularly felt at the Arctic Council, that has put Russia in a much more difficult position. And, you know, at that time, you know, certainly in the research we've been doing, you can see up till even the very end of 2021, the kind of official Russian state newspapers were really playing up Arctic Council cooperation and the fact that, you know, there was a kind of cordoned off area in U.S.-Russia relations.
Even when the council was paused, you're saying?
This would be just before.
Okay, just before.
So
okay.
Just right up. So you think February 2022 with the invasion.
Right. Yep.
So they're literally, you know, looking past the, you know, I mean, acknowledging that, you know, after 2014 and the, you know, Russian occupation of Crimea, et cetera, mm-hmm. and the beginning of sanctions that really started to target the Arctic.
And it was somewhat celebrated that the Arctic Council continued in
That's
an
right.
exceptional manner, exceptional in that they were able to continue.
That's right.
Okay.
Well, the seven Arctic democracies more or less gave Russia something of a free pass, I think, in retrospect, and, you know, continued to try to work that, you know, to make this idea of Arctic exceptionalism actually viable. I mean, that became untenable with the full-scale invasion, clearly. So, you know, after that, we see, you know, the NATO kind of, you know, encroaching on Russia, trying to contain Russia narrative coming out very, very strong out of Moscow. But it's not completely new stuff. You know, they have various narratives working through the media. The media is completely either controlled by or mm-hmm. subordinate to the Kremlin. And that talk about, you know, NATO in the Arctic, which is generally, you know, kind of U.S. in the Arctic, NATO in the Arctic, kind of means the same thing.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about it's hard to separate the war in Ukraine and obviously, and then Russia's interests in the Arctic. I mean, they're connected. Mm-hmm. How has this war and Russia's ongoing involvement in it, mm-hmm. now that it's, you know, surpassed 3 years, and mm-hmm. I think I read over a million casualties, it has asserted, and as I mentioned, President Putin asserted even just a few months ago, its desire to have this grand strategy that's predicated on the Arctic, mm-hmm. yet it seems like the majority of its resources are being poured into Ukraine, which is not, you know, to the naked eye, really doesn't have anything to do with the Arctic, and yet it's investing all this time and effort into this conflict. Is somehow Russia benefiting in the Arctic region because of the conflict, or is it taking away from it? I mean, is it? And then, if you're in the NATO perspective, is there some sort of benefit for Russia to maybe if they were quote unquote from some others draining resources there, does it take away from its ability to operate in the Arctic and therefore, you know, impact Russia's strategy in the region?
Yeah. Well, I think up front wants to be very clear, Russia is a big loser in the Arctic because of what it's done in Ukraine. I mean, the loss of access to the technology, the cooperation, the cultural exchange, indigenous relations, etc. These have all been damaged by Russia's decision to, embark on the full occupation of Ukraine in February 2022. So I think that needs to be kept up front. There's no doubt that the resources being allocated to the Ukraine war deflect from resources that otherwise could be part of the mix in the Arctic, for socioeconomic development. Mm-hmm. So it's hindered them in that sense as well. Where I have think that the Arctic has maybe, become more important to Russia in that framework is that, the Northern Sea Route is providing, something of a mechanism to really accelerate its pivot to Asia. To China, particularly. So the Arctic has gained more importance that way for them. Obviously, the oil and natural gas coming out of the Arctic is absolutely crucial to the Russian state's ability to fund war in Ukraine. So the Arctic is, absolutely crucial. The Yamal, LNG, and other oil fields that are there. So that has accentuated the Arctic's importance. Then when you look at Russian strategic documents, either published just before or since the February 2022, you see that, far and away, Russia's preoccupation is still very heavily Ukraine, number one, but Belarus and Central Asia and, other parts of what was once the Russian Empire and Soviet Union still is, the near abroad that they unpopularly in the West put it. Mm-hmm. But the Arctic is the second priority in many things. And when it comes to maritime strategy, et cetera, the Arctic is really number one. And this ties back again to the natural resource development questions, and as well as Russia's, security and its own sense of vulnerability in the Arctic.
My last question on this that focuses solely on Russia is more related to the current events here and the war in Ukraine. We saw Ukraine strike, a number of airfields across Russia, some in or near the Arctic, some frankly just far away from either the front lines or from Moscow. Some of which have impacted Russia's nuclear capabilities. Absolutely. In the platforms that would deliver some of this weaponry. If you could, for a minute, for someone who's studied Russian grand strategy and those that created, does this have an impact on its psyche at all? This particular strike on, especially when it starts to enter into its nuclear capabilities?
I would think if it didn't enter into their psyche, they would need to ask themselves some questions. I think there's going to be a very large, the implications of what Ukraine has done here with such an innovative attack, both, in terms of war fighting in general, but then specifically to, Russia's strategic bomber fleet. This isn't a capability that's not easily rebuilt. And while, we're still get a sense of confirming the numbers at this time, but, to lose any amount of those aircraft to this. So I think it's going to play in quite a bit to the perception of fear. The fact that it was launched internally from Russia, is quite astounding that, again, the ability of Ukrainian intelligence to stage an operation successfully like this. So I have no doubt that this is, I think, almost as much as anything else that's happened in this war, just shows how it's not separate from the overall calculations of global security and stability. And again, this is ultimately an own goal by Russia. None of this would be happening if they hadn't taken this imperialist line towards Ukraine. So, I think, it's going to take quite a bit of time for this to map out. But it's a little bit like the shootdown of MH17 back in 2014. Yeah. And what that did to the European psyche about dealing with Russia.
Yeah.
It took many, many years to fully, come round, and they're still sorting it out. But I think this is an event on that level.
Yeah, so much more I could dive into there, but I want to switch gears here briefly and focus a little bit on Canada itself. Your expertise in Canadian matters is also vast. We talked a little bit about Russia, but in terms of Canada, and I could even draw some parallels to talking about the strike and the attack in the Russian Arctic, places that used to seem far off and hard to get to. Canada's Arctic is far off and hard to get to.
Right.
as many celebrate the success of such an attack, does that change how Canada approaches Arctic security now when we see new innovative approaches on getting to locations that otherwise probably wouldn't have been able to be attacked, either mm-hmm. kinetically or otherwise? I mean, what challenges is Canada facing in the Arctic region today that you see when you sit at MLI there, adjacent to the capital, in the ministries there in Ottawa?
Well, we clearly need to be thinking about new technology and the impacts that they have, and you know the effects of climate change, you know, the potential for more traffic associated with natural resource extraction, et cetera. So that kind of hybrid warfare kind of context, I think, is something we need to be thinking about. Obviously, the Arctic, you know, has a number of dimensions, so we can't, you know, kind of tunnel vision on that sort of thing. Some of the very, you know, classic threats, if you will, nuclear submarines, you know, strategic nuclear arsenals, etc. The innovations that we're seeing occur in that from both Russia and China, I mean, these all have relevance to, you know, how security is done in the Arctic. For sure. You know, Canada, I think, has to do a fairly considerable reconsideration of its Arctic posture. This has picked up steam in the last, I would say, 18 months or so. Certainly in the late Trudeau government, you know, more investments confirming the F-35s, the kind of rebuilding of our mid-air tanker and a refueling capability, the, you know, getting into service the Arctic offshore patrol ships that are ice-capable warships, lightly armed, but nonetheless Royal Canadian Navy presence, the decision to buy the P-8s, patrol aircraft, and as well as some UAV suites to work in the Arctic, you know, speak to this repeated statement that's come from parliamentary and Senate committees, from organizations like MLI, other think tanks and academics in Canada, that, you know, situational awareness, the sense network, you know, we need to build up a lot to be aware of what's going in the Arctic, yeah. Of which the sort of, you know, again, this extremely innovative attack that the Ukrainians have done, you know, I think fits in that spectrum. So there's a real balance here, I think, between thinking about, you know, some of the more things that we're accustomed to thinking about, you know, fighter aircraft, ships, presence. Canada, you know, so we have that sensor part. The other part I think that's getting more attention is the response part. So again, this goes back to NORAD. You detect it. What do you do? You know, where do we need some of the development? Well, obviously on the aerospace, you know, a lot of the technology needs to be upgraded. You know, the current government has announced, you know, moving forward continually on NORAD modernization with a new radar system purchased from Australia. Obviously, we can come back later to the whole discussion around Golden Dome and some of those, but there is also just the factor of having capability and infrastructure in the Arctic. And a lot of the stuff that Canada needs to do is not particularly, I would say, glamorous in the sense that it's not all about F-35s, right. And et cetera. Quite a bit of it's about building docks, yeah. Having deep water ports, having airstrips, barracks, yeah. You know, all these things that would allow the Canadian Armed Forces, the Coast Guard, to have a better operational footprint mm-hmm. and be there. I mean, again, not just to deal with China and Russia, but also to expand their ability to allow for the economic development of the North, to better serve the many communities up yeah. there that are very remote. So, you know, there's a general need to improve infrastructure, you know, in a region that, you know, most of the electricity is generated by diesel mm-hmm. generators, right? Yeah. So I think there does seem to be a stronger moment in Canada right now that there's a sense that as a nation building project, that this can be done in ways that, you know, assist the people who live in the North, you know, Indigenous communities, treaty right holders, and the territorial governments to help accelerate, you know, telecommunications, you know, local infrastructure, water and sewer, very basic things, while also improving, you know, the Canadian Armed Forces and government to operate there.
Yeah, you touch on a lot of important things here. I mean, the infrastructure that you speak to can serve for many purposes. At least this is what I'm hearing, and this is what we've seen in the U.S. Arctic, notably across Alaska, that it, you know, could. The basic infrastructure exists to defend the homeland, if mm-hmm. you will. You need the basic infrastructure there to support the sensors, the platforms, or the people that are going to do it, but also to project power if you're going to have an F-35 or other platforms that need to get out further afield. But at the same time, having those resources there, as you're saying, can support the local communities, either economically or with the logistics and resources, perhaps having a cleaner, more reliable source of power. In our backyard here today in Anchorage is the Sustainable Energy Conference where a lot of these conversations are playing out. And I think yep. just before this, I was reading about the application of micro nuclear reactors that could serve right. in some of these remote communities. So a lot we could get into there, but you did mention, I'll take this opportunity to talk a little bit about the Golden Dome, mm-hmm. This initiative now. to me, it seems there's an implied role for Canada here. We've already talked, you mentioned NORAD, and again, we just sit here not too far from the Alaska component of the NORAD binational command. Mm-hmm. This is still maybe in its nascent stages here. Some proposals have been thrown out there, but how do you envision a Canadian role in this, both from the Golden Dome itself, but maybe infrastructure development opportunities that they could accompany it?
Yeah, right. And certainly, you know, a lot of opportunity for innovation development and thinking about, you know, our overall technology sectors and so on. So look, I mean, I think Canada, you know, because of the NORAD framework, as you mentioned, binational, a very you know, unique structure in terms of how two countries deal with their collective security on a whole continent. You know, that the initiative around a Golden Dome is obviously something that Canada should look at seriously. And, you know, our Prime Minister, Prime Minister Carney, has signaled that Canada will be, you know, in discussions with the United States about this. You know, obviously from President Trump, there's an opening bid here. I mean, you know, I doubt Canada will pay for one third of the entire system. And, you know, I think we do have to have, you know, in Canada, very independent, you know, discussion about, okay, does this meet our security needs? Is this the best allocation of resources? You know, going back to this change that we've seen in Canada in the last 18 months is, you know, a push now towards meeting the 2%, you know, NATO, you know, floor for payment or of commitments of investment, which Canada has been neglectful on, I'll be very blunt. That is going to push past to 3.5% in our larger discussions. So Canada is looking at, you know, and Canada's a G7 country, 40 million people. This could be a substantial reinvestment in capability that will greatly strengthen NATO and NORAD and others. So, you know, whether this is the right piece to be putting a, you know, a very large part into, you know, the Golden Dome, you know, of course we'll have lots of questions about the viability, the timelines, obviously the infrastructure and how that will be set up. But I mean, Canada and the United States should be looking at all times. I mean, our interests in the Arctic, our interests on this continent, when it comes to hard security and those big questions, align very, very closely. Mm-hmm. And almost anything one does is going to strengthen the defense and security of the other. Way better to coordinate that. So, you know, I think we got a lot of runway, obviously, to be thinking about, you know, whether the Golden Dome model, but there's no doubt that, you know, the situational awareness, these kind of, you know, new technologies, hypersonics, et cetera, are going to entail new solutions. And that should be, I think, a priority discussion between our capitals.
The threat landscape has changed since some of this infrastructure was originally built, the distant early warning system and whatnot is what I'm referring to. You know, back in the Cold War, the threats were primarily emanating from what was then the Soviet Union, and now China enters the fold with its capabilities and its posture and its location, frankly, primarily emanating from across the Pacific, as opposed to maybe perhaps from directly over the pole, as we would have perhaps seen previously. Here in Alaska, we're at the intersection of the Arctic and the Pacific, but so is Canada.
Yes,
in many ways, Canada is a Pacific country. To me, it seems that there's a growing strategic importance of the Pacific, North Pacific, Arctic Pacific region, perhaps, both in an area in which the United States and other countries, say perhaps Canada, would project power either together or on their own. But at the same time, there are threats emanating from it. A couple months ago, I had the chance to speak with the Canadian Foreign Minister Joly at the Munich Security Conference, where she talked about the tenets of the new Arctic security policy of Canada. In it, she mentioned its specific orientation, some of the initiatives that Canada would take there, to include perhaps opening a consulate here in Anchorage, just one of many steps. I was hoping maybe you could talk a little bit about Canada's Pacific orientation and some of how its Arctic policy can impact or shape that, or vice versa.
Yeah. Well, I think if you look at our Indo-Pacific strategy, which, you know, kind of, I've been saying 18 months, like a little bit before that period, you know, we released an Indo-Pacific strategy. And this, you know, I think reflected an understanding in Canada, as in pretty much everyone, that there needed to be a rethink about how we approach China, but also the economic dynamism and you know of the whole region. I mean, India as well, of course, but also Southeast Asia. In that, you'll find in the Indo-Pacific strategy, which I believe is 2023, could be 2022, it slips my mind, they mention the North Pacific kind of passing language there about, you know, connections to the Arctic. If you turn then to the defense strategy, which came out, you know, new defense strategy, Our North Strong and Free last year, it also starts to, you know, talk more about Canada has three full coasts that we need to defend, plus the continental security dynamic. So that again creates new opportunities, I think, to think about the Indo-Pacific, you know, the Northern Pacific as a part of this interface with the Arctic. But also fully acknowledging the Atlantic component, and you know the Arctic is something, you know, of its own space, but also a transitional space between some of these other more, you know, better strategically defined vectors. So, you know, I think both Finland and Sweden's joining the alliance, and what we've seen going on with China and Russia in the Bering Strait and the Sea of Ohotsk, you know, leading into the Chukchi Sea and the Beaufort Sea, you know, are definitely things that, you know, should be heavy as catalyzing more thinking about these kind of how the northern flank of NATO interacts with the eastern and the very rarely talked about western flank. From a NATO perspective. Western flank comes up in Canadian discussions, as does the endorsement of the concept of a northern flank. You know, if you look at Russian strategy, for instance, I mean, two, I think, areas really become super, super important to them, you know, strategically. Maybe I can add a third, but if we're talking about the Arctic, the Barents Sea, you know, north of Norway, is hugely strategically significant and sensitive to the Russians because of the export of oil and gas that continues to Europe and to other places. And then, you know, the kind of Chukchi Sea Bering Strait, which is the, you know, eastern kind of point of exit or entry to the NSR, the Northern Sea Route from the Pacific. Mm-hmm. So I think that these two kind of spots, you know, certainly bear the need for a lot of consideration about, you know, how we support one another in that and show that there's a unified approach to, you know, looking at, you know, certainly it's China and Russia's right to apply those waters, international waters, et cetera, that we'll be very attentive to, you know, how that affects the threat picture.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of attention had been paid more toward the Barents region when it came to the Arctic conversation in Russia vis-a-vis NATO. In the western/northern flank, as you mentioned, gets a little bit less attention. I think a few podcasts ago, a few guests ago, we had talked about just the inherent connections between different regions of the world and how the Arctic's impacted. And we used the example of when shipping was shut down in the Red Sea because the Houthi rebels were firing rockets on somewhat indiscriminately on ships. And at one point, it seemed as if Russia was condoning this particular activity because they were pushing shipping around that particular choke point, whether it was originating from somewhere that had to go through the Strait of Malacca, through the Indian Ocean, and up through the Red Sea, and more so from, say, East Asia straight up north, where the Russians might have more control. And a lot of those products that were leaving Asia were actually going to Europe and really kind of remove the bearing Chukchi component of this connection. Mm-hmm. And now I think more eyeballs are being paid to or paid attention now to this particular region, the Bering Sea region, again, the Arctic Pacific, the North Pacific, to include some Sino-Russo collaborative exercises that we've seen now, whether they're jointly campaigning in some sort of integrated capacity or simply sailing and flying next to each other. Maybe you have an opinion on that, but those steps seem to have escalated, at least in size and frequency, over the last 1, 2, 3, and perhaps even into this particular year. What is your take on the Sino-Russo collaboration, notably in sort of the Pacific realm of the Arctic here, not far from, at least proximately, closer to where we are now here on J-Bear than, say, if you were over doing a conference in Oslo or Helsinki or Norway? After all, we're still in NATO terrain, NATO territory, but the strategic picture looks quite different depending on where you sit. Different. So what's your take on the Sino-Russo collaboration in this part of the world?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, just to step it back one bit, I mean, you know, the Russian-Chinese cooperation has been absolutely essential to Russia and its ability to survive the sanctions regimes, et cetera. And, you know, as often as pointed, Russia is the weaker of the two partners in this relationship. I think then if you take that to the Arctic as a whole, though, the dynamics do shift a little bit in that, you know, China is facing a lot of problems with the rest of the Arctic community in terms of its ability to do science, to invest, et cetera, because of concerns about what those investments and activities actually entail. Military-civil fusion is one of the ways that people talk about it, you know, and what are, you know, what's the effect of if China opens a mine, you know, what other things is it going to be used for? Where does the ore go for processing? Is that actually strengthening our own economic security here? So I think when you start to talk about, you know, this region, well, you know, obviously this is where the China part is going to, you know, where they have the power projection capability, you know. So, you know, and the Northern Sea route is very much part of Russia's idea of how you pivot to Asia. It's the Russian pivot to Asia. You know, given the challenges they have with South Korea and Japan right now, I mean, that's heavily a pivot to China. Although there certainly are other players in the region who are open to interaction with Russia economically. So, you know, I think China sees this as, you know, from a strategic perspective, it is an alternative, or at least, you know, they want to continue to look at the prospect of Arctic shipping as a way to deal with problems that may, you know, get out of hand in the Straits of Malacca, in the Red Sea. Now, the Northern Sea route remains perishingly small as a route for international shipping. I mean, I think you know, everything we saw go through the NSR last year, which was a record year, you know, would constitute about, you know, a 20th of what goes through the Suez Canal in a month. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's clearly no at this stage, you know, no comparison. But the Chinese are interested. They are investing. There's a lot of, you know, kind of advanced proof of concept, I would say, in some cases going on to establish routes to be there, symbolically important to China. Russia is really the only option China has for doing this. So, you know, this particular area, you know, like in the work that we've recently done, you know, you do see, say, from the governors, that interest in China is extremely high in the Barents Sea region because, you know, so much of their economic relationships were with Europe and are badly, badly disrupted. You know, Chukotka and these areas, Yakutia, I mean, of course, much more sparsely populated. You know, interest in the natural resources and the connections, but also some of the, you know, more pronounced efforts from their governors, et cetera, to build the people-to-people contacts and, you know, have lasting, you know, kind of create that long-term depth to the relationship. So I think, you know, we do need to have this comparative perspective between what's going on in the eastern and western flanks and how this kind of intersection with the north is going on. But, you know, it's a place where China can signal to the United States that it's, you know, and Canada, that it's able to be present here. It has rights to be there under international law, you know, as we would all accept in international waters, and a way for Russia, you know, for them to do side by side to show we're also able to project power here. I mean, I think we shouldn't get too carried away. China's ability to project power in the Arctic is quite limited, certainly compared to Russia's at the moment. But that will change, and they want to signal that they intend for that to change.
At least trying to progressively grow capabilities that
and they will grow those capabilities. Yeah. I mean, I think there's no doubt.
The NSR, it's got a lot of attention over the last number of years, I suppose. And it gets attention because you read headlines that say, you know, the record year for tonnage, record year for ships, record year for the length of the season, record for latest ship to transit, earliest ship to transit. But you still pointed out that even on its biggest years, according to tonnage, somewhere in the realms of it's a 20th of what goes through the Suez in a month. Mm-hmm. Is there a number or a metric that would indicate a true, not necessarily viability of the Northern Sea Route, because we know that products can ship through it. But, you know, when if I'm an international, if I'm in international shipping, is there a number there that suddenly says, whoa, this has fundamentally changed the game? Mm. So the headlines can be a bit, well, they are accurate in the sense that factually, you know, it's expanding, growing, et cetera. Is it a big deal, not a big deal, and when might it be a big deal where suddenly with the U.S. and its allies, its presence in controlling the high seas and the Indo-Pacific and the South China Sea suddenly starts to cede control, not because they don't have the ability to, but suddenly because the shipping's simply just going elsewhere that the United States and its allies might not be. Mm-hmm. Is there a metric, a number, a time in which that might change in your eyes?
Yeah, I'm not sure I have a firm number, not being a total expert on international shipping, but I mean, like I said, it's perishingly small compared to the Red Sea, you know, Suez Canal, Panama Canal kind of options. You know, I think, you know, the Russians are about halfway to where they said they wanted to be. Putin had said 80 million tons. I think they had 40 million last year, thereabouts. I know, I think their longer term one is 120 million tons. You know, I think this is kind of a progressive step up. You know, I think right now with the sanctions environment, it's very hard to see, you know, when I talk to people in the industry, you know, appetite for the Northern Sea route is still fairly low because it can't do some of the other things that the other routes typically can, which is primarily on-time shipping, right? I mean, you know, both because your clients need the product when they ask, plus the dock time, et cetera. I mean, these are all, you know, very competitive environments. You can't have a ship that, you know, yeah, the Northern Sea route in optimal conditions, you know, cuts a very large amount of time after over from transits from Europe to the North Pacific. But if you can't guarantee that, that's a big problem.
Yeah.
So that puts a big barrier there. You know, so, I mean, I think the Russians are putting in, you know, of course, you can make some of this happen through a large state subsidy in the form of Rosatom Flot and the nuclear icebreaker fleet that can, you know, work all year long. You know, if you build some of the ice-reinforced ships, you can really push the season out, et cetera. But, you know, I think we would need, you know, to see sanctions disappear and uptake from European.
Yeah.
You pointed to this. So much of what, say, China wants to do, whether you're talking about Belt and Road, et cetera, is get to Europe. Right, you know, go through Central Asia if you're talking on land, but you know, it's a building an infrastructure corridors along which it can, you know, develop and get access to resources, develop new markets. But it's that big attractive market of, you know, in the European Union that it's you know, they're really, really interested in. So I think you would need to see, you know, a very large increase at least in, you know, certain commodities moving or goods moving on a regular basis for longer periods of time. Mm-hmm. You know, Arctic shipping in general, I think, you know, there's, I like to talk about both the resources and the shipping. There's a perception that these things are going to develop.
Yeah.
Humans pursue perceptions. So we have technology, you know, we do these things to open it up. But, you know, industry and it looks like cost. You know, we're looking at efficiency, and those challenges are still very, very real. I mean, these will never be easy places to navigate, you know, because of ice and light conditions at the very least, regardless of how much global warming changes the overall profile. So, yeah, I don't think I have like a firm number to say, but I mean, we would need, you know, an order of magnitude or more.
Sure.
I mean, Russia is coming from a very low. That's why it looks like rapid growth, because it was a very low threshold to start.
Yeah. Yeah. And people just entering the fold in the Arctic security conversation sometimes get a little bit distracted by the literal headline or the top line statistic as opposed to the whole conversation. So I think the context is important. You need a great job there explaining.
Let me add to that, too. Yeah. But I think that's one of the key things in assessing the Russia-China relationship in the Arctic, right, is that a lot of times we put up, oh, well, do they really trust each other or they have a history of these problems? But, you know, right now the Northern Sea route, you know, is heavily a Russia-China route. And we're seeing that constant progress everywhere. Right? You know, maybe it's incremental, maybe it is from the low threshold. So I think when we assess the relationship, we do need to think that, okay, yeah, there are, of course, they're not perfectly, you know, these are authoritarian countries. They don't trust most of anyone, you know, internally or externally.
Right.
But the relationship has continued to grow and build and has overcome quite a few of these challenges, and that the kind of current strategic glue holding them together and this onus to kind of keep cooperating with the Arctic is one of the more unique and globally visible areas where they can do work together, you know, I think means that the relationship has a lot of legs.
So more kind of agree to not trust one another, yet there's this mutual benefit that is the glue that holds them together.
Well, that's the alignment of strategic interests, right? I mean, if you think you're in rivalry with the United States, that it presents a threat to your regimes, your regime survival, you know, that's a very strong motive. And, you know, it's also, the current relationship allows Russia to concentrate on Ukraine. They don't, you know, think as much about their Western borders, et cetera, and it allows China to concentrate on the Western Pacific. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, there's a very big geopolitical takeaway from the current relationship, you know, in authoritarian systems. Of course, there could be pivots, but right now, I think that relationship has, you know, continual ways to go as it continues. Even if it plateaus, it's plateauing at a much higher level than it was before. Sure. And, you know, a lot depends, of course, on the U.S.-China discussion, the Russia-Ukraine situation, the future with Europe. You know, so many, many things can affect it. But, you know, it certainly solves a lot of problems for each one of them by cooperating.
To begin to wrap up here a little bit, curious to know where you might find some additional opportunities for the U.S. and Canada to cooperate, either in the Arctic region or even to follow on what we were just talking about here in the Arctic Pacific region going forward. Both countries are making a deliberate effort to enhance its presence and capabilities in the region. Both are, well, of course, allies, binational partners at NATO, have this very similar, if not the same, strategic interests in many capacities. What new or additional opportunities might there be in your eyes, based on your experience and some of your outlook on the future?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say first off that, I mean, thinking about the North American Arctic, we constantly have to be thinking about Greenland, and the Kingdom of Denmark is also here to have a very broad conversation about protecting the northern approaches to our countries and homelands. I think that's a very crucial part in thinking. I think that then leads to, you know, enhanced discussions, particularly around maritime security, how we develop NORAD's maritime security dimension, you know, what needs to be done there, you know, getting towards questions as we started off with, talking about, you know, different forms of hybrid threat, protection of subsea fiber optic cables, all that sort of infrastructure. You know, I think, you know, looking at what the Russians are doing, I mean, the Russians are by far the most ambitious for the development of the Arctic, of any Arctic country, I mean, by a very large margin. You know, we don't need to emulate that. Mm-hmm. We don't need to even compete with that. Right. You know, in Canada's case, we have a lot of natural resources in other parts of the country that are, you know, potentially more feasible to develop in the short to medium term. But I think we do, Canada, the United States, and Greenland, need to be having a conversation about, you know, what sort of economic future do we envision for our Arctic? Mm-hmm. And I think we should have, you know, this idea that the Greenlanders have put forth of North-North cooperation in their strategy, you know, how we bring together the knowledge and skills and needs of indigenous communities, you know, most of which cross, you know, the borders, you know, so having this very, you know, not just Washington, Ottawa, Nuuk, and Copenhagen, right, but having the conversation that's getting the local actors, the local governments, sure, the Alaska State, the corporations here.
The Whitehorse, the Yellowknife.
Absolutely. Halloween, you know. So thinking about that dimension, I think we should really be looking at an Arctic development. That can have an economic security development, of course, and foreign investment and how we handle that, you know, which I think is the primary challenge from China, for instance. And then I think it ties into other things like icebreaker construction cooperation. I mean, you know, this is captured a little bit in the ice pack deal with Finland. But Canada, you know, is maybe a little bit ahead, I think, of the U.S. in this right now. We should be working, you know, together on this. I mean, sectors that in Canada and the United States are very protectionist. We should really be looking at, I mean, minimum North American solutions, but probably more optimally transatlantic and trans-Pacific, because given the South Koreans,
exactly. Yep.
So, you know, I think we really want to make sure that none of our friends and allies have latent capacity that's not moving ahead because of parochial political interests, and, you know, icebreakers and having a, you know, again, our icebreaking needs in the Arctic, you know, ultimately probably have the most to do with our economic needs, you know, servicing, you know, making it viable for mines, tourism, you know, whatever the northern community and the nations agree on is a feasible approach to the future. So I think there's some really rich opportunities there. Opening a consulate in Anchorage, you know, great idea for Canada. You know, let's get those people-to-people's ties going, you know, get our business sectors. We're competitors in a number of things, oil and gas, et cetera, but sectoral security, economic security demands that we have these discussions about, okay, how do we build the competitiveness of the sector? How do we build the resilience of the sector? Mm. So I think we have so many shared things here. You know, Canadian ships have shadowed Chinese icebreakers going through the Bering Straits, you know, Navy and Coast Guard. So there's definitely a burden-sharing relationship that we can have here. And, you know, when it comes to those questions, I mean, Canada and the U.S., you know, it doesn't make a lot of sense for us to be not collaborating on this and finding the dimensions where, you know, our assets can, where we can exercise together. I mean, there's no loss to me in doing these activities. And, you know, we should bring some of our other Nordic and European partners and even Japan, et cetera, you know, kind of into these mixes,
bring
just kind
in
of
the
show
fold over here,
and show like what we're capable of. Again, not as a threat to China or to Russia, but just as a
North.
Yeah.
We could get into much, much more. I'm afraid we might even not have enough time, but we have a vast network out there across the world, 2,400 or so alumni and other people affiliated. You live in Ottawa. Maybe not everybody's been to Ottawa. If they were to spend a day and a night in Ottawa, where would you direct them?
I'm a huge CFL fan, so you know, checking out an Ottawa Red Blacks game is always something I'd recommend.
The Grey Cup.
If you want to get a little sample of the northern version of favorite North American pastimes. I always look forward if any alumni are coming through. I always keen to chat with folks who are interested in the Arctic.
We'll send them your way, and then perhaps during your voyages across Canada, what's a place that stood out to you that you maybe try to direct somebody to?
I'm a native Newfoundlander, so I'd be totally wrong if I didn't say, you know, Newfoundland and the East Coast, if you want to
think Atlantic Canada.
Atlantic Canada is a beautiful spot, very hospitable people. I always so keen on historical ties to New England, and American visitors are always totally, totally welcome, as are friends from around the world. So, again, if you're interested in the Arctic, St. John's, Halifax, I mean, these are part of the Canadian Gateway system to accessing the Canadian Arctic. So I'd be wrong if I didn't give a good pitch for Newfoundland and the East Coast.
And it was a good one. Alex, thanks for taking the time to educate us, share your expertise, and visit the center. It's great to have you in Anchorage, and looking forward to have you back again soon.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
Very good.